The Ambitious Radio Network. Conversations with ambitious entrepreneurs and thought leaders. Are you an entrepreneur, startup junkie, or just someone interested in improving their leadership skills? If you're looking to be motivated, inspired, and uncover what it takes to get to the next level, listening to Ambitious Radio will be well worth the investment of your time. We have weekly engaging conversations with today's most influential thought leaders and entrepreneurs as they discuss their successes, failures, tipping points, and other priceless information that you can apply immediately after listening. Now, here's your host, Doug Parker.
All right, welcome back to Ambitious Radio. This is your host, Doug Parker, and today we have another good one for you. We've got Miss Dori Clark, and Dori is the author of the new book, Entrepreneurial You. Her past books include Reinventing You and Standout, which was named the number one leadership book of 2015 by Inc. magazine. She is a former presidential campaign spokeswoman. She also teaches at Duke University and writes frequently for the Harvard Business Review. Welcome to the show, ma'am. How are you?
Hey, Doug, I am good. Thank you. It's great to speak with you.
To you as well. I've been looking forward to this interview for a while, and, you know, there's lots of great stuff going on. I know you got a new book that's out, and, you know, you're all over the place. I see you're writing, and, you know, you're doing other interviews just all over the place. But let's just talk a little bit for our audience. For those that don't know who you are, tell us, you know, who you are. Where did you grow up? What are you all about?
Well, thank you. Yeah, I grew up in a small town in North Carolina. It is called Pinehurst, and it is well known, perhaps only if you are a golfer. It is considered by many to be the golf capital of the world.
Ah, interesting. So I have to ask, are you a golfer?
Absolutely not. That was my teenage rebellion was not golfing.
I got you. You know, I'm not much of a golfer either, and it probably was because I wasn't that great at it, but I tried for a while, and it just wasn't, you know, for whatever reason, my deal, and but I don't blame you. You know, it's just one of those kind of things that you either get it or you don't, and it's a cool sport. Lots of people do it, but it's not my deal either. So now, like, when you were growing up, I mean, you're in a small town, Pinehurst. What did you want to be when you were growing up?
Well, you know, my first great love, Doug, was I wanted to be a spy. I was a big James Bond fan, so I thought that was just about as cool as you could possibly get. But ultimately, I guess I ended up with a job that is possibly the opposite of being a spy, which is writing books and giving talks.
Yeah, you are in the public for sure.
Yeah, so I may have blown up those aspirations. I probably wouldn't be too effective these days.
Well, hey, no worries at all, because you are very effective at what you do, and you know, you've got the entrepreneurial kind of mindset. You've written a book on it, but I know that you're teaching as well. And I'm gonna throw something out there, and this isn't directed towards you, but I have heard before that, you know, those that can't do teach. I've heard that before, but you're actually out there doing as well. So tell us about kind of your journey, you know, just from a standpoint of from childhood and then kind of going through becoming who you are today. How did you go from, you know, kind of quote unquote wanting to be a spy as a kiddo and then being in the public and out in front and teaching and writing?
Well, you know, one of the things that was important for me early on was, because I never really felt like my hometown was a great fit for me, I wanted to try to get out as fast as I could. And so I had a lot of different schemes to think about how to do that. But what I ended up doing, which I feel very grateful I had the opportunity to, was leaving to go to college early. So I was able to enter a program at Mary Baldwin College in Virginia to enter college when I was 14. So I started there. Then I ended up graduating when I was 18. I had transferred to Smith College in Massachusetts, and so I finished up there when I was 18, and then went on and got my master's degree. I actually went to Harvard Divinity School and finished that up when I was 20. So I was able to kind of accelerate the process a little bit, which was really fortuitous, and so that kind of gave me a good head start, at least, to be able to get out into the work world.
Sure. Now, so you mentioned that, you know, hometown, you know, wasn't a good fit. I know a lot of people, they run into a situation where, for whatever reason, they want to get away from home. But was there anything specific that made it not a good fit? And is it something where you reflect back years later and you still feel the same way, or have things changed a bit?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm actually going to be doing a reading for my new book, Entrepreneurial You, in November in my essentially my hometown, the town next to it, which is Southern Pines, and so it'll be nice to go back there. And the last time I did a book event at this cute little bookstore, the Country Bookshop, that was actually where I had my first paying job. So it's nice to come back there. It's always a warm welcome, which is wonderful. But yeah, the truth is I still try to avoid vast swaths of North Carolina.
gotcha. Now that I understand. I grew up in East Texas, which is a little different. I'm in the Dallas area now, but you know, I love it. I love the people there, but I'm glad I've moved on. And sometimes I go back and I reflect. I talk to people and I hear some of the things that they say, and I'm like, what in the world? It's like nothing's changed in the last two or three decades. And it's just a different dynamic. And you know, people, Zig Ziglar was a mentor of mine, and Zig used to say people don't change their mind, they make new decisions with new information. And you know, I go back there and I remember maybe having some of those thoughts before, but I feel like I've kind of, processed through it with, you know, being exposed to other things, but so many people have not. And it's just kind of a weird dynamic. But anyway, with that being said, 14 years old, went to college. Now, obviously you're very bright. There's no question about that. But how did that opportunity become exposed to you? Because there's a lot of smart kids out there, but 14 going to college, that's a huge deal.
Yeah, thank you. I was very fortunate because I was not the first person in my community to do it. It was kind of on my radar because there were a couple. It was at a women's college, at the time it was a women's college. Mary Baldwin has now gone co-ed, but so there were a couple of other girls from my town that had done this early college program. And so it was, you know, on my radar, it was talked about. And so I figured I would give it a try. But it's not a fit for everybody, obviously. I mean, sometimes you get a 14-year-old in college and, you know, you can imagine they're not necessarily prepared for it. But I was an only child and my parents were older when I was born. And so I had really grown up around adults. That was kind of my peer community. And so I was totally fine being mature enough for college. I mean, you know, it's not like I needed a lot of external reinforcement. The entirety of my college career, I didn't drink, you know. Mm-hmm. I wasn't allowed to drink. I didn't drink. That was not a problem for me. I was not chafing against those rules. It was just not something that I was interested in. So I was able to be pretty focused. And I think too, there's this saying, I think from Nietzsche, a big enough why can endure anyhow. And so college was just so clearly superior as an option for me as compared to being in my little town that I was gonna do anything to be able to be successful at it. And so I adjusted pretty well.
Cool. Well, you know, being an only child, I know exactly what that's like. And growing up, for whatever reason, I didn't think the world revolved around me, but as I, you know, grew up and got married and other things, I realized that I had thought the world had revolved around me. So it creates a really interesting dynamic. But I kind of had the same thing with just being around a lot of adults. I didn't have a lot of kids. I got along fine with kids, but they weren't seemingly my friends. It was more older people that I could learn stuff from. And sounds like that you went through some of that as well, and that was a great fit for you. So now we talked about some of the good things. What about obstacles? What type of obstacles have you had to persevere through? Maybe, you know, through your childhood or youth, and then maybe even as an adult.
Well, you know, if we're talking about obstacles, I wouldn't necessarily call it an obstacle per se, but part of the reason why I was so acutely aware that I wanted to get out of my little town was, you know, when I was a a kind of young teenager, I realized I was gay, and that was just not, this is pre-internet, mm-hmm. and so this was just not a thing in mm-hmm. my town. It was not not only not talked about, I was out to myself for a year before I ever met a gay person, and you know, I wanted to put myself in a different and more accepting environment, and so that was something that you know, it's not really a challenge, although it's a in an objective sense, but it was a challenge in that environment, and so it ended up being a great motivator for me. I think, you know, other challenges that I think about, which, you know, I mean, the good news is if you handle them right, they can be good spurs to action. A big one for me was getting laid off from my first job. After I finished grad school, I was a newspaper reporter, and I ended up working for about a year as a reporter, and then losing my job very suddenly. And it was really depressing because I liked journalism and would have wanted to stay in it, but it just wasn't a possibility given what was happening in the industry at the time. And so it forced me kind of ahead of the curve to reinvent myself and get comfortable with reinvention. And it turns out that has been a skill that is valuable in the current disruption-prone economy, although I certainly didn't know it at the time.
You know, I interviewed Nadia Zexenbaeva a while back, and, you know, she is all about reinvention. And I saw a TED Talk she had done, and I was like, I've got to try to get this lady on the show. And so I followed up for like 4 months, different directions,
wow.
and finally was able to get her on. But it was very, to me, eye-opening, because, you know, you come from this school of thought in the past where, you know, you want to do something, you want to become an expert, you want to, you know, have how many ever years of experience. The problem is, though, is if you, you know, those that cannot adapt become extinct. And it, you really do have to, with the speed everything is going, you have to continue to reinvent yourself. Even if it might be in the same industry, you have to do things differently. And, you know, that was really interesting, you know, how you said that, just being comfortable with reinvention, you have to be able to do that. So that's a cool thing. Now, you have a lot of folks, obviously you're writing with Harvard, and you've got a lot of exposure to others, but is there anything in particular that you do to continue to grow?
Yeah, absolutely. I am very acutely aware of not wanting to stagnate. And so, for instance, I give myself little projects. So in 2015, I was traveling all the time, on the road a lot, in support of my last book, Stand Out. And at the end of the year, I kind of took stock and realized I have been just running around so much. I've barely been able to enjoy being in New York. And so I made a commitment that I would try to take a little bit more of a relaxed pace in 2016. And so I made a commitment that I would do what I called a uniquely New York activity at least once a week. And so that meant for me, you know, maybe it's going to a museum, maybe it's, you know, doing some cultural thing, you know, going to a festival, whatever it is. But I wanted to really feel like I was taking advantage of the city. And so I started tracking it and keeping a spreadsheet, and really became conscious of wanting to maximize the value of the place that I lived, so I could just experience new things and not just be treating my home like a hotel room. So that's been really good for me.
Cool. That really is. You know, it just got me to thinking. My wife had sent me, I was out of the country for a little while on some business, and she sent me like this list of stuff that she'd like to do. And it gave me some direction so that I could just, you know, kind of not plow through it, but, you know, like schedule things, because it was things she found interesting. And so I'm just picking these things off of it and scheduling them every week or two to be able to do that. So sounds like you're kind of being proactive, but on a grander scale with that, and tracking it, you know, on a spreadsheet and everything else. That's really super cool. Now, you know, change, you talked about the reinvention and some of those things, but is there anything that comes to mind maybe over the last 5 or 10 years that you've kind of done a 180 on? You were thinking this way, and then you were exposed to something different, and it made you kind of pivot a different direction.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, one thing that I did, which was kind of surprising for me even, was that I lived in Boston for a really long time. I was there for 17 years. I went there for graduate school and then just stayed. I bought a house there. So I assumed that I was just going to settle down there. And I was very involved in civic life. That was something that I spent a lot of time doing. I was on the board of, you know, a local civic groups. I got involved in politics. I knew all the politicians, you know, so I was very tightly plugged in. And ultimately, I decided to move, and I ended up moving to New York 3 years ago, which was a really big change to undertake, one that kind of felt risky to me since I had spent so long building social capital in Boston. And, you know, I knew people in New York, but I didn't have at the time any close friends in New York. So it's not like I really had a lot of people to pave my way there. So I very much had to reinvent my social life while I was in the city. So that's been kind of a big deal for me. And really that was spurred in a lot of ways. You know, I don't know if I would have done it otherwise, but I had a cat for 17 years, pretty much as soon as I moved to Boston, I got him, and he died in 2013. And it was really traumatic for me. You know, we were really close. He was like my best friend, and it was so sad for me to be in the house with him not there that I just felt like the only way to break out of that depression was to sell the house and move. And I thought, you know, it's kind of silly if you're going to move to like move down the street. So I thought maybe it was a sign that I needed to kind of reinvent my life. So I ended up doing that.
You know, that's an interesting deal. And for those that don't have pets, they may be thinking, that's crazy. But I can tell you, my family has had, we had two dogs for like 15 years, and then one of them passed away, and then the other one like a year later did. And we've got two new dogs now. And I say new now, they're probably, I don't know, they're 2 or 3 years old now. But it is a huge thing. I mean, you know, the thing about these animals, they give that unconditional love, and we say that we're supposed to do that to our family and all that kind of stuff. It's more difficult to do for some reason with family, but animals, they really do give you unconditional love, and it's a different kind of a deal. And it's interesting that, you know, that's the series of events that led you to New York. Now, fast forward, you said 3 years, 4 years later. Now, obviously, you got 4 years in New York. You've gone through, you've you know, established some new social relationships and such. So do you feel like you're going to be firmly planted in New York now, or do you plan on maybe moving somewhere else or back to Boston at some point?
Yeah, I think for the time being, New York seems like a good fit for me. So I've started looking around at maybe buying a place here. I've been, you know, renting since I came, but I think I would feel good about putting down roots. It's not to say that circumstances might change in the future, but it definitely seems like a good place for me to be right now.
Cool. Very good. Very good. Now, I'm going to talk about a couple of other things. I know you've got some great books, and we're going to actually talk about your new one that's coming out in a couple segments, But let's talk, in addition to your books, are there any other favorite books that you have or recommendations you might have for our audience?
Yeah, in terms of like my books and where to start, Doug, or
well, so let's do this. Let's talk about maybe if there's some in addition to your books, maybe there's an author that you really like or something along those lines, and then I do want you to kind of clean that up later with the books that you have and what's in them in our third segment.
Got it. So some of the books that I really love, I mean, if I'm rattling off business books that I think are just, you know, particular classics, I am a huge fan of Influence by Robert Cialdini. That's something that, you know, I could recommend 100 times a day, because it's so useful, not just to business people, but to anyone who wants to understand human psychology. It's Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. I think we all need to persuade people in order to be effective at life, basically. So that was really transformative. Some other favorites that I have, the E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber is a fantastic book for anyone who is a business owner, you know, runs a small business, and particularly people who got into a certain trade because they like doing the thing. This is a book about how to kind of separate the act of the service you provide with running the business about the service that you provide. So a really useful framework. And then another one that's high on my list is Never Eat Alone by Keith Ferrazzi, which I think is kind of an all-time great book about networking.
Those are some great ones. And, you know, what I always love about asking these questions is there are always a couple books that, you know, you've heard of before. You know, E Myth Revisited, people, you know, talk about that one a lot. So it's, you've got these books that if you haven't read them, you got to go read them because everybody says you have to read them. And then there's always some that are, you know, kind of outside of that window. So thanks for sharing that with us. Now, when it comes to quotes, things that you've heard over the years that you really like, or is there a favorite quote that you have?
Yeah, you know, one of my favorites that I really try to live by is from Theodore Roosevelt, and he says, "In any moment of indecision, or any moment of uncertainty, the best thing you can do is make the right decision. The next best thing you can do is make the wrong decision, and the worst thing you can do is nothing."
Oh,
and I'm really big into that. I think that too many of us just navel gaze for too long, and you're not going to find out if it's the right or the wrong decision unless you do something. So I try to let that govern me.
You know, I love that. You know, when I was preparing for the interview, I had seen that, and I actually applied it. I was working in one of my businesses, and someone had I needed an answer on something literally from 2 weeks ago, and I just emailed them that quote. And I'm like, look, I just need a decision. It doesn't even matter if I don't like it. Just give me a decision where I can move on down the road, even if it's the wrong one. And she printed it off and like stuck it on her cubicle wall. So it was a really interesting that, you know, that's what I love about this show for me personally is I get to interview people, but I'm picking their brain. I'm getting information. And I hope that's what our listeners get as well. We get lots of great comments about, you know, just how much they learn from from the folks we're interviewing. So really the last question I've got for this segment is really, I got two. Advice. So everybody likes to give advice, but is there anything you can reflect back on that's like, this is one of the best pieces of advice I've ever received?
Yeah. I think that a conversation that I think back to, it was years ago, it was like 2006, or maybe 2007. I had just started my business, and there was a guy who I knew who was a businessman. He was one of the, you know, he's kind of an investor type. And he was, frankly, one of the few people at the time that I really knew in the business world, because I, prior to starting my business, doing marketing strategy consulting, I had been running this nonprofit. And so he was one of our board members. And we met up for coffee, and he was encouraging me to start an email newsletter. And, you know, at the time, I didn't really see the value of it exactly, but he was very adamant that it was important. And so I started doing it. And, you know, honestly, I did it pretty haphazardly for a lot of years. But I did do one, and I did have one, at least in a kind of a very basic way. Now, I've gotten a lot more serious about email marketing and communicating with people that way over the past couple of years, and now it's kind of a cornerstone of my business. I am a big advocate about the power of reaching people through opt-in email lists, but I would have been starting from less than zero if it weren't for Jake encouraging me to get started in kind of a preliminary way with having an email newsletter to begin with.
Excellent. And then really the last question of the segment is what is one of the personal habits that has contributed most to your success?
You know, I think that when it comes to personal habits, if we're actually just, you know, thinking about something that really is ongoing and habitual, I'm a big fan of the news, and I want to defend it because I feel like the news is under attack from so many fronts. One front, of course, is the kind of productivity gurus who say, "Oh, you waste so much time reading the news. You shouldn't read the news." Blah blah blah. And then it's under attack from people on whatever side of the political spectrum saying, "Oh, all the news is fake anyway." Blah blah blah. And as a former journalist. There is really excellent news being created, at least in some places, by journalists that truly want to make true things known to people. The journalists that I know are some of the people who are just the most intelligent and civically minded people I know. I really feel like it's a calling that they want to make people aware of things that people should be aware of. And I think that in terms of being an informed person and an informed citizen, me just reading the newspaper every day is one of the best things that I do. I mean, I run across plenty of people sometimes, and they might be intelligent people, but they are not well-informed people. And you notice, and you see that. And when you find as I did recently with a colleague of mine, somebody who doesn't know that Scotland is a part of the United Kingdom, or something like that. You're just like, wait, how did you miss that? and it kind of makes you wonder, well, what else don't they know? And so being, reading the news, just getting that sort of daily dose of being an informed citizen, knowing what's going on in the world so that you can make good judgments about business and about life and society, I think is an enormously valuable thing to do.
It's interesting. I love speaking with educated folks for multiple reasons, but I went to the School of Hard Knocks. I got like a PhD in the School of Hard Knocks, but I never had an opportunity to go to college. My wife did, and both of my kids are going to college, but it's always interesting because I look back and you're exactly right. People that, they're intelligent, but not well-informed. And I think I've got I'm a relatively intelligent guy and I've self-educated on so many things. But over the last 20 years, there were times where I look at something and I think, I used to think, I didn't go to college, no big deal. I've made some good money. That was fine. But I look at things and I love just knowledge. I love things like history and geography, and just that same example of Scotland you just talked about. Well, not everybody knows that, and you don't normally get exposed to that unless you're educated on those things. And you mentioned the news and some of those things. I've kind of pulled back because I got where I was watching news like all day long in my office, and I would hear five different talking heads but say the exact same thing. I'm like, I'm
you definitely
really
don't need 24 hours a day of it.
Exactly. It was too much. So I'm kind of an all or nothing kind of guy. So I just kind of pulled the plug on it. And I guess it was about October of last year. I just said, I'm not watching news anymore. Cause I get too tied up in
that
it.
Timing a coincidence, Doug? Well, I wonder what happened around then.
there was some crazy stuff that was going on. It really, really, really was. But so you said newspapers, what you like to read. So is there a specific newspaper that you generally like to read?
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan of the New York Times. I mean, they have they have the most resources as a newspaper. They're still one of the largest. I mean, them, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal are really the players that still have enough money and funding and commitment that they are able to dispatch their own reporters to events rather than relying on wire stories or doing analyses of other people's coverage. So I think that's probably for me the place to go. But and it's not even, when people think news, they think, oh, that has to be, you mean current events or you mean politics. And I mean, yes, that's part of it, but even just feature stories can teach you so much about life. A study about the anthropology of a certain remote tribe, or a piece about, you know, some cultural custom that they might do in Japan. You know, whatever it is, it just opens up this slice of the world that, you know, there's no way that you would otherwise be exposed to it unless you happen to travel there, you happen to meet somebody who's from there. And things like that, I think, are tremendously powerful.
Absolutely, no question about it. If you're just tuning in, we've got Dori Clark here with us today on Ambitious Radio, and she is slaying it. I mean, she's talking about lots of great stuff and kind of growing up, how she progressed, you know, through some, you know, just unique obstacles. We all have different ones, but, you know, they sharpened her up for different things, went on to Harvard and just, you know, lots of great stuff. But now in the next segment, we're going to kind of jump into the entrepreneurial journey itself. And I know that you teach, you also have written some books. So can you talk a little bit about your books and what prompted you to start writing books and then that entrepreneurial journey, that part of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I first got serious about wanting to write a book in 2009. I had been running my business for a few years and decided, you know, okay, this is my chance. This is me gonna, you know, I'm gonna take it to the next level. And so I got all set on wanting to write a book. So I did it what turns out is completely the wrong way. And I ended up spending the first 6 months of 2009 writing three different book proposals because my thought was, oh, well, you know, one of these is going to be appealing. Someone's going to want one of these. And of course, that was exactly the wrong way to think of it. What publishers really cared about and do, in fact, still care about even more is your so-called platform, meaning it's not, you know, yes, it's the idea, but even more than that, it is how famous are you? How many books can they expect that you will sell? That's what they care about. And so I did not really have much of a platform in 2009. And so all my proposals just fell short. They were not interested in them. So I really had to kind of start from square one. So I started blogging very assiduously in 2010 and was able then finally to get a book contract for my first book, Reinventing You, in 2011. The theory worked. It was actually from a blog post that I wrote, which then became popular and got turned into a Harvard Business Review magazine piece. And then from there, I was able to sell that as a book deal. So that worked out really well, but it was a much slower process than I would have wanted or imagined.
You know what? I love learning from these people so assiduously. I hear that. I'm like, what? Assiduously? What in the world? I know it means something a lot or something. But anyway, I Googled it real quick. With great care and perseverance. So that's the word of the day, assiduously. And
yes,
ma'am. So we learn here on Ambitious Radio every time we have someone on here. Thanks for sharing that with us. And so it turned into a Harvard Business Review article, and then you've expanded, you know, upon that. Now you write for them on a regular basis. Now, what do you do like on a regular basis to monetize your efforts? I mean, so you're a teacher at you're a professor at Duke, right?
Yeah, that's that. I do that part time. So that is one of the hats that I wear. Exactly.
So what is it? Not that you have the most fun doing, but what occupies the majority of your time?
You know, my business goes kind of in waves. So right now, for instance, as we're having the conversation, I'm about to launch my new book, Entrepreneurial You, and so the book launch period becomes really intense. And so I essentially calendared off for my 2017, the entire second half of the year as essentially book launch related activities. So in some cases that's doing podcast interviews, in some cases that's writing, blog posts, in some cases it's speaking engagements around it. But it's all kind of tied in with that. But you know, of course, few months after the launch, things will calm down a little bit. But I would say, broadly speaking, I have, and this is really the subject in many ways of Entrepreneurial You, since it's about how to create multiple income streams in your business, I have worked very deliberately over the past, say, 4 to 5 years to specifically do that, to create multiple income streams in order to just, you know, to open up new opportunities, to mitigate risk, etc. And so I actually divide my time pretty well, pretty evenly between doing executive coaching, doing paid speaking, writing books, and a little bit of teaching. That's sort of a smaller piece. I do plenty of one of the new activities that I've undertaken is creating an online course called Recognized Expert. So I spend a lot of time with that as well. So there's a variety of activities.
Well, let's dive in and talk about the book, because you know it's up and coming. It's Entrepreneurial You. But tell us about what our listeners, they go get the book, what are they going to get out of reading this book?
Yeah, so essentially, Doug, the problem that I tried to solve in Entrepreneurial You is kind of a big one. My last book, Standout, was about how to become a recognized expert in your field, which obviously is important for a lot of professionals, a lot of entrepreneurs. You want people to respect you. You want people to come to you and say, well, I don't want the cheapest option. I want Doug because I know he's going to be great. That's kind of how we want to have things structured. But the trick is, as I was touring around and giving speeches and talking to people about this, I came to realize, while it is essential, it's really important to become a recognized expert in your field, and that has powerful dividends, there's kind of a final frontier. There's one other problem that needs to be solved, which is that we can probably all think of a lot of people in our lives that really are talented, that really are knowledgeable, they're experts, they're great at what they do, they have a lot to contribute, but they just are not able to really make money. They're not really able to make a good living doing what they do best. And so in Entrepreneurial You, I wanted to write a book about that, about where the rubber meets the road. It is a book about how to make money, essentially. And so I interviewed about 50 very successful 6, 7, 8-figure entrepreneurs. These are not people who are running large corporations. These are folks who have enormous profit margins and are running either solo businesses or very small businesses, made up of multiple income streams, and I interviewed them about how they did that, very specifically. What is their business model, and what can regular professionals and entrepreneurs do in order to replicate that and harness some of those resources for themselves?
That sounds excellent, because one of the things that we run into as entrepreneurs, and we throw out there the serial entrepreneur and all that stuff, it sounds cool and everything, except for a lot of entrepreneurs are scattered on their thinking because they got all these great ideas, and then if they can't focus them in, then they're just spinning around, kind of like squirrel every few seconds, looking at something else. So finding a way to focus those talents but still have the multiple streams of income and not just be chasing the next quote-unquote big thing, I can't wait to read this book in depth myself and really learn from it, because it's a struggle that I personally have, and there's things I hear it over and over again, and we've all heard it since we're little kids, that if you can do what you love to do, you'll never have never have a job or never have to work a day in your life, or whatever the case may be. And I enjoy what I do, but some of the things, like, I love interviewing people because I love to learn, and I love to, like, there's these aha moments, where I hear something I hadn't heard before and I want to go research it. And, if there's a way to have 100% of my time talking to people and getting paid for it, that would be pretty cool to me. There's just different things, and I know our listeners they're gonna get a lot out of the book. Now, if they want to, get the book, do you have a website? What's the best way to go get it?
I do indeed. Yes, the book is Entrepreneurial You is certainly available on Amazon, Barnes and Noble, etc. But if folks especially want to learn more, I do have a free resource that they can download. It is the 88 question Entrepreneurial You self-assessment, and it actually walks people step by step through how to identify multiple income streams in their business and how to take steps so that they can begin to implement that. So if folks would like to get that for free, it's doryclark.com/entrepreneur.
That is excellent. So we'll put a link to that on the site on Ambitious Radio. And as always, all of our guests are profiled on the website. So you can just go to the site, look for Dory Clark, and then we'll put a link to that 88 question survey, and that will be excellent. Thank you for sharing that with our group. We'll put a link to it there. So let's kind of dial back for just a second, because you've done a couple different things, and just talk about, you know, maybe fears that you've had as you've done some of these things. I know you talked about the book and you had an idea of how to do it. Sounds like you just went after it and came up with three different ways, but have there been any fears or things that you've been reluctant to do? And if so, how have you processed through those?
Yeah, you know, if I think about fears in my business, there's not been a kind of clear thing that it's like, oh, you know, I'm afraid of doing it, like, you know, people who might be afraid of public speaking or something, let's say. What I have certainly experienced a lot of is just the real challenge of focus and prioritization, because there are a lot of things that I want to do in my business. I mean, I'm with you, Doug. I love talking to people, interviewing people. I would love to start a podcast, but I know, as you do, that to do it right, you really need to make a conscious and concerted effort. You can't just, you know, mess around and do an episode here and then 6 months later you do another episode. That's not going to be effective. That's not going to help anyone. You really have to choose that and prioritize that. And so it's enormously frustrating for me, just temperamentally, to have to say no to a lot of things that I would like to do. I'd love to start a podcast. I'd love to do a video series. I would love to be able to, you know, there's some different online courses, some shorter courses that I think would be very cool to offer. All those things are pretty neat, and it would be great and fun to experiment with that. But in order to get the big things right, in this case for 2017, it was doing a joint venture launch of my online course, Recognized Expert, and then launching my book, Entrepreneurial You. I figured, you know, two activities is really all I can do effectively, two big ones. You know, each one will maybe take six months out of the year to really focus on and emphasize. But if I got those two things right, then a lot of other things downstream would fall into place and be more effective. So it's just the self-discipline of being willing to choose and to kind of make the sacrifice of the things that you either can't do, or at least you can't do them now.
Yeah, that makes sense. And you know, we've talked a lot about some of the successes, because you've definitely accomplished quite a few things. I was watching an interview the other day with Oprah and Steve Harvey, and they were talking about failures. And, you know, Steve Harvey, I think he said something to the effect of, is that the more failures you have, the more successes that you have. Do you have a favorite failure? Is there anything that at the time it was like just seemed so terrible, but then you fast forward a few months or a few years later and you're like, that one really taught me some stuff?
Yeah, sure. I mean, certainly the layoff early in my career was a big one. But I mean, you know, especially early on, it was a little disheartening, because I just seemed to not be able to get career traction. I'd come out of school and I'd done well in school, but it took a while for things to come together. So, for instance, I originally thought that I was going to be an academic, and I got a master's degree, and then I thought, okay, I'm going to get a doctorate. I'll be a professor, which of course I now know is not, you know, the greatest career choice. I do it part-time now, which is great, but a full-time tenure track position is extraordinarily hard to get, and in many ways a thankless task. But that was what I thought I wanted to do. And I ended up getting turned down by every doctoral program that I applied to. And so then I get the newspaper job, and then a year later I get laid off from that. And so then I start working in politics, because I had been a political reporter. And so I work on two successive very high profile campaigns. There was a gubernatorial campaign and then a presidential campaign, and they both lost. So it was a little ridiculous early on. So I was forced to be very resilient and to get good at reinvention.
You know, it's, and I'm glad you shared that, because so many people, they get just down in the dumps and you know, something happens, and a lot of people, you know, they think they want to be an entrepreneur because they don't want to work for somebody. And there's a few more moving parts than just you don't have to work for a boss. All of a sudden, now you have to work for your employees. You have to work for, you know, all your customers. It really changes the dynamics of things. But when you go through those hard times, it sharpens you up. It trains you, and it gives you some different trajectory. There's an old song. I think it was Garth Brooks, but it was like a, you know, thank God for unanswered prayers. You know, sometimes you want something so bad, and you think it's what you really want. And then in hindsight, you look back and you're, I'm sure I'm glad I'm not that, whatever that would have been. So great, great information. Well, again, speaking with Dory Clark, entrepreneurial expert, writes for the Harvard Business Review, teaches at Duke. I mean, just knocking it out of the park in every way. New book, Entrepreneurial You. It's a great book. I'm ready to really dig into this thing and learn a whole bunch. But now we're going to kind of slow it down just a little bit and just talk about, how do you recharge your ambitious body, mind, and spirit? What is it that you do to recharge and relax? Because obviously you got a bunch going on. Do you have that kind of work-life balance all figured out, or how does that all work for you?
Well, I definitely don't have it worked out per se, but I think part of the way that I think about it is that I try to be gentle with myself when I am in a kind of overwork phase, because I think that sometimes the conversation about work-life balance implies that every single day you need to be balancing things out. And I think that that's kind of an impossibly high standard, and one that may be self-destructive. Because the truth is, I mean, for instance, right now, I am in kind of peak frenzy because I'm just about to do this book launch. And so, you know, for the past few weeks, and certainly for the next few weeks, things are going to be nuts. I don't have a lot of time for recreation or anything like that. And I feel like part of the battle is just accepting that and knowing it's okay. This is the crunch time. You know, if you're ever going to be promoting this book, now is the time. Now, you know, you got to launch it well. But then realizing and building in, okay, you know, as we get toward late 2017, toward the end of the year, the beginning of 2018, that's when I can slack off a little bit more. And I need to build in that time. I am not going to be launching any new books in 2018 or 2019. So I can go into a little bit of a slower pace. I mean, of course, you always, as an entrepreneur, need to be marketing your business, but you don't have to do it at a fevered pace. And so building in that time and knowing that it'll come is valuable. But in the moment, to answer your question, I am trying to make sure that even amidst the craziness, that I'm not letting up on my fitness routine, just to kind of keep my body in working order. So I do spin classes a lot, and I do bar classes. That is a kind of trendy thing in New York now, where it's kind of a ballet-inspired fitness, which I have to tell you, for anyone who has not done ballet, like, ballerinas are just the toughest human beings in the world. I would not want to see them take on a football player, because the ballerinas would win. These courses will kill you. So they're a good workout.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I saw somewhere in the last couple of years where actually a football player, I think he was probably a running back, but he was taking ballet classes because of the strength and conditioning and the extreme balance. You know, when they're trying, yes, to like tiptoe down the, you know, the line or whatever, it was something that he was trying to incorporate into his game to help him out. And you look at these ballerinas, I mean, they, the control they have over their body, it's like they can contort things around. It's crazy. So it's, I could only imagine. I'm gonna leave that up to you, because I don't know. Is there any, did you ever see any guys in there? Do they look kind of funny in there if they're in there?
You know, it's interesting. I feel like, you know, my message to single straight men out there is, this is an untapped marketplace here. I mean, I've, out of 100 people in you know, like a week's worth of classes, maybe two are men. So if you just want a room full of very attractive ladies all to yourself, this is an amazing opportunity.
There you go.
Yeah, I think it could be good. But yeah, you know, you can, you know, it's all about core strength. So everybody needs that. I mean, sort of their favorite activity with doing these, you know, there's a million exercises, but if you just kind of picture the kind of thing that they have you do, if you can picture sitting down in a chair but there's no chair, and you have to hold yourself up like a chair for like minutes on end, that, like, whoa.
You know, I think that's a form of punishment, of torture they do, where they have you squat down and hold your hands out in front of you, kind of. I've seen that before, so I could only imagine people that are doing it just to, for exercise, if you will. So do you have favorite places that you like to vacation when you want to unplug? I mean, do you get to do that?
You know, I don't take, I mean, you know, like everybody else, I like Paris, you know, things like that. But I don't take, at this point, a lot of concerted vacations. What I more typically do, because I'm traveling so frequently for business, is that if I am being sent to a place that I've never been before, I'll try to tack on a little extra time so that I can explore it and just leverage that. So, for instance, I gave a TEDx talk a few weeks ago, and it was going to be in Lugano, Switzerland, which was cool, but there are no direct flights from the U.S. to Lugano, so I instead flew into Geneva, and I was able to explore there. I'd never been to Geneva. I was able to take in some business meetings, but also be a little bit of a tourist. And then it turns out Lugano is very close to Milan, so I flew out of Milan and was able to get a couple of days there to experience that. So those are the types of vacations that I usually take, and it's fun, because you feel like, all right, I'm doing a business trip, but I'm at least getting to see a little bit of the world as well.
Yeah, that's super cool, and that makes sense. I mean, you know, when you're traveling, a lot of people don't get to travel very often. They travel as, you know, 2 miles to their office and back every day. So travel probably isn't as exciting of a thing for you necessarily, but getting to take in and leverage the already travel miles while you're there to take in a little bit extra, that's excellent. Are there any, you know, documentaries or movies or things that, or even a book that maybe is not a business book, but just something that you like to read or listen to recharge?
Well, you know, one book that I read recently that was a real page turner, it was great. I'm going to give a shout out because this is written by a friend of mine, but it was called The Witch of Lime Street by David Jayer. And it was so good. It was really so impressive. David is he's a very meticulous historical researcher. And so this book was a true story, and it was about a kind of showdown in the, I guess, the 1920s, where Harry Houdini, in addition to being, you know, a famous musician, magician who we've all, you know, still heard of, one of the things that he was big on at the time was debunking spiritualists. You know, he was because basically he said, like, hey, I'm a magician, I know how these tricks work. And at the time, there was a lot of people who were saying that they could communicate with the beyond, and he said, no, you can't. And so he set out to debunk them. And so it's kind of this story, a true story, about a showdown between Harry Houdini and this woman who was considered the leading spiritualist of her day, and was very respected in society. She was a Boston society wife, and it was kind of about how Harry Houdini was taking her on and attempting to prove what he thought, which is that she was a fraud. So it has a lot of cool suspense to it.
Excellent, excellent. Well, you know, again, I love hearing all these different books and different things to read or listen to. Let's talk about rest, and we're almost to the end of the show. It's hard to believe it. I blinked and we've gone through everything, but what type of rest? I mean, do you sleep 6-8 hours a night? What does your daily rhythm look like? Of what time do you get up? What time do you go to bed? Is that a standard operating procedure there for you?
Well, you know, mostly it's standard when I'm home, although because I'm traveling so often, it does get thrown off. Yesterday, I got up at 4:40 in the morning because I had to catch a flight from Louisville back to New York so that I could have a day full of meetings in New York. But I would say if left to my own devices, I would, you know, it's pretty normal, I would say. I'm certainly not, you know, one of these, like, oh, I don't need sleep kind of people. I probably go to bed around maybe 11 midnight, wake up, let's say 7 a.m., 7:30, something like that. So I'd say pretty well on average, but I'm a big believer in rest.
Cool. Yeah. And it's, I like to ask that because there's a, out of all the interviews that I've done, most people are 6, 7, 8 hours. There's only been a couple, like literally 2 or 3 that are the 4 or 5 hours or 2 or 3 hours a night people. And I always wonder, you know, is it something where it's just a matter of time? You know, is it something where they can grind it out for 10 years or so, and then all of a sudden, because your body just has to have rest. I sleep a solid 8 or 9 hours every single night, and I couldn't imagine operating on 5 hours forever. Every once in a while, you know, I got to get up early too and do something, but I try to make it up by, you know, recovering the next day or two. But anyway, well, let's see. When it comes to, you know, people contacting you and engaging with you, maybe they want to hire you as an executive coach, or maybe they want, you know, some of those types of things. How is the best way to interact with you? I know you're on your social, but what's your preference?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, probably the easiest is folks can just email me through my website, which is doryclark.com. And that way it's a direct pipeline.
Love it. That is fantastic. Well, I want to tell you that I really, really thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. I know that our audience will enjoy hearing it as well. And thank you so much for investing a little time with us to let us learn from you.
Hey, Doug, thanks for having me on. Great to talk with you.
Yes, ma'am. And thanks to all of our sponsors. Ambitious Radio could not do it without you. Tune in on Saturdays to Ambitious Radio, where we interview thought leaders and exciting entrepreneurs changing the faces of their organizations. Remember, you can make money or you can make excuses, but you cannot make both. So go out there and be ambitious.
Thank you for listening to the Ambitious Radio Network, hosted by serial entrepreneur Doug Parker. Join us weekly as we have engaging conversations with ambitious entrepreneurs and thought leaders on topics that can be applied immediately after listening. Like what you've heard? Listen to other interviews at ambitiousradio.com or subscribe on iTunes.